Cheers erupt in Iran as its national men's football team plays the United States in a World Cup first-round showdown. But these were not the typical cheers of Iranian fans celebrating a goal by their team. My VOA Persian colleague joins me to explain. Plus, a special session of the UN Human Rights Council takes unprecedented action on Iran. We'll talk to a Baha'i activist who participated. And later in the program, we ask an analyst why the US and its allies are keeping the door open to talks with Iran as it keeps advancing its nuclear program.
The idea is that formally closing off the negotiations wouldn't gain the West that much, and it could provoke even more significant Iranian nuclear advances.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning, I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran's World Cup team needed to avoid defeat to the U.S. in its final first-round match on Tuesday to have a chance of progressing in Qatar. But the Iranian men fell 1-0 to the U.S. on a first-half goal by striker Christian Pulisic, meaning it is the Americans who move on to round two. This is how it sounded at Washington's Astro Beer Hall, where I watched the match with the American Outlaws, the main group of supporters for the U.S. national team. The U.S. goal also drew cheers in Iran's predominantly ethnic Kurdish city of Sanandaj, as we hear in this video posted on social media. Sanandaj is where many residents have been infuriated by their government's brutal crackdown on a mostly peaceful protest movement. For more on the match and the reactions from Iranians, I sat down with VOA Persian journalist Arash Sagarchi and asked for his thoughts on what we saw.
At this period of the time, I didn't follow World Cup very carefully because of the situation in Iran and all work we have to do with coverage of Iranian
protests. It's like preoccupying you.
Exactly.
Right.
Personally, in each World Cup, I follow Iran games, U.S. games, and Argentina. But for this year...
That's another team. You also like Argentina?
Yes.
Okay.
But I never had a chance to see a single game except today's game. And today's game was very important for many Iranians because we can see Iranians were divided two parts. Many people, they believe this national team is not their team. And at the same time, many pro-regime trying to say this is our national team.
Right. Do you have mixed feelings about the result, given that Iran is your home country, yet, you know, here you are living and working in America?
You know, as a journalist and as a reporter, I started my career as a sport reporter 25 years ago when I was a teenager. And at the time, we learned, hey, we cannot mix our feeling with the games and covering as a, you know, reporter. So I don't feel that way, but I can see that, how people divide it. I never see that kind of feeling between Iranian who they believe this national team is not their team. And it is, honestly, the first time I saw Iranians were happy when Iran national
right.
team lost to England.
It's very strange. For fans
strange.
From other countries, they probably can't understand
I never
that.
Saw such a thing in my whole life. But in second game, when they beat Wales, some people were happy. But today was another story as, government started to put some big speakers to celebrate that, to prepare for the celebration, but at the same
time. There's no celebration now, I guess.
I guess so, because we saw several videos right now before coming to the studio to talk to you. We saw after U.S. goal, many people, many videos we saw in Kurdistan, in Tehran, in other cities. People were happy when U.S. Got their score.
How are they expressing, you know, this happiness?
I saw several videos, and based on them, I can say they try to use this opportunity to repeat their, slogan and criticize the government and the regime. I can see several videos, people gathered and chanting and be happy and start saying what we have here in last 2 months.
What do you think comes next for this Iran team? There were reports that, you know, these players have been under pressure. from the government? I mean, have you heard anything to confirm that, you know, players' families were approached by government officials? What do you know?
We tried to reach, but the issue was everything was ongoing and we didn't get any proper response. But next week's, we can see some, because many of these players, they played outside of Iran, and then they would have a more opportunity to talk about the details.
Oh, so you think we should wait and see what they might say after they go back to their clubs in various parts of the world?
Yeah, exactly. Some of them, they are playing in Europe, and they have a much opportunity, and maybe they can, you know, help their family to left Iran, and then they speak up.
We shall see. Arash Sagarchi, a managing editor in the VOA Persian service, thank you so much for sharing your reflections of the game with me here in the studio.
Sure, thank you for having me.
The UN Human Rights Council has approved the creation of an independent fact-finding mission to investigate alleged human rights violations in Iran since it began violently suppressing nationwide anti-government protests in September. Ahead of the November 24th vote, council members and representatives of human rights groups made their case for why a fact-finding mission was necessary. One of the speakers was Baha'i International Community spokesperson Simin Fahandej. I spoke with her by phone and asked how Iran's crackdown has been affecting Iranian Baha'is, a long marginalized religious minority.
So you see, the Baha'i community is unique in that it is affected on a daily basis by the different areas of persecution, like being arrested just from their homes and for being Baha'is. So the numbers of Baha'is related to the protests, that's a number that I wouldn't have. But the number of Baha'is that we know that have been arrested generally for being Baha'is is 29. Since September. And you may know also that in August, actually just before the recent crackdowns happened, we had just in a single month, we had 300 incidents of persecution against the Baha'is, including arrests, expulsions from universities, economic pressures. So for that 1 month, we had 300 incidents.
What role did the Baha'i international community play in the diplomacy that led to the Human Rights Council holding a special session on Iran?
So the Baha'i international community represents the Baha'is at the United Nations. So it is here as an organization that works on different issues. So we are very interested in questions of human rights violations that take place in Iran generally, because the Baha'i community has been one of the most persecuted groups in Iran since the Islamic Revolution in 1979.
Well, you certainly did have a seat at the table at the special session, and you gave a short statement along with representatives of governments and other NGOs. What are your personal observations of how the special session went?
Yeah, you know, there was a very different feeling in the room than usual Human Rights Council sessions, I have to say. And, you know, there was just this sense that the human rights violations that have been happening are so real, and the people that have been dying on the streets are just so so obviously innocent to the world that, you know, sitting there and listening to kind of state after state giving their speeches, it was really, really powerful to have. For example, there was the German delegate who held up the booklet of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and said that the human rights in this booklet are not up to anyone's interpretation. And to have kind of all of these countries hold Iran accountable, and for this body, this human rights body of the United Nations, to hold Iran accountable for these human rights violations was a very powerful moment. And I think the reason that it was powerful wasn't what's been happening over the past kind of couple of months, but also I think everybody was conscious that this isn't something that just started now. This is something that has been going on for over four decades. And I think that's what made it serious. And that's for all of us who have been working on Iran for so long. It was kind of this moment of truth and accountability for these 43 years, for these four decades.
Well, how likely do you think it is that Iran's government is going to cooperate with the fact-finding mission and allow its members to visit the country, which is what they would have to do to be effective?
I mean, I hope that they do. I hope that this fact-finding mission sets a precedent for an important accountability mechanism for the UN, in the case of Iran, of course. Of course, in the case of the Special Rapporteur on Iran, which is another mechanism of the UN to kind of investigate human rights crimes of a state, there is a Special Rapporteur on Iran, and he's never been allowed to go inside the country. And of course, I'm sure you've seen his reports. I mean, whoever is a special rapporteur, their reports have always been kind of full of the descriptions of all the human rights violations against Baha'is and other groups. So in the case of the special rapporteur, it hasn't happened. But of course, we hope that it will, and that Iran will cooperate.
Well, Simin Fahandej, UN representative for the Baha'i international community, speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland, thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me and for covering this very important issue.
Visit voanews.com and click the Iran tab at the top of the page for updates on Iran throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. UN nuclear agency IAEA confirmed last week that Iran has begun enriching uranium to 60% purity at its Fordow underground nuclear site. It's the first confirmation of Iran using its most advanced centrifuges at Fordow to enrich uranium that is close to the purity needed for a nuclear bomb, something Iran denies wanting to build. And that activity is happening underneath a mountain that would be difficult to penetrate for any foreign power considering military action to stop Iran from becoming nuclear armed. The U.S. and its European allies have said they are no longer focused on negotiating with Iran to get it to resume limits on its nuclear activities. But they haven't given up on diplomacy completely. To find out why, I asked analyst Henry Rome of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
So I think in this case, the U.S., Iran, and Europe are actually on the same page, albeit for different reasons, that keeping the kind of possibility or the idea of a deal alive serves everyone's interests, at least at this point. From the U.S. and European point of view, I think the idea is that formally closing off the negotiations wouldn't gain the West that much, and it could provoke even more significant Iranian nuclear advances. And I think from the Iranian point of view, clearly they benefit from being able to play on the world stage if negotiations were to resume. And more importantly, keeping that prospect alive allows the Iranian government to kind of continue to dangle the prospect of a deal to its domestic audience. That has economic effects, that has political effects, and also to try to avert, although this is becoming quite difficult, the kind of unification of Western governments in opposition to what Iran is doing, so to try to divide Western governments. So I think that's the kind of state of play right now. I think that really becomes difficult over time. And I think the challenge here is that if the West were to declare the negotiations functionally dead, it does mean that the West will have to come up with a strategy for the day after. And right now, the options on that front are not very good. So I think for the time being, that's the equilibrium.
When it comes to a strategy for the day after a potential permanent breakdown of these nuclear talks, how aligned do you think the U.S. and its European allies are on what that kind of strategy would look like?
So I think one of the points about the past couple of years that we should keep in mind is that the U.S. and Europe are on the same page. And there are some variations on some issues. The European governments maybe have a different position than the U.S., and there are tactical differences. But from a strategic point of view, there is a fair bit of alignment, or there has been, I should say, on the nuclear negotiations. And I think I would expect that there would be as well on developing kind of alternatives for what were to happen, let's say, if there were to be a pursuit of snapback at the UN Security Council. I think the U.S. and the E3 share the kind of broader objective here of ensuring that Iran can never develop a nuclear weapon. And I think I would expect a great deal of effort being put in to try to ensure they remain on that same page. But there's quite a bit of unknowns about what especially the kind of next year looks like, and if the breakdown of negotiations is formalized, kind of what that would look like. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done on that front.
What do you anticipate will happen if Iran keeps making these incremental advances in its uranium enrichment? Do you foresee a time when the West will look to snap back these more serious UN Security Council sanctions?
So I would expect sometime over the next year, if the nuclear deal is not revived, that you would see a snapback at the UN Security Council, largely because at the end of next year, in October of 2023, some additional restrictions are lifted on Iran, and in particular the missile program and several kind of UN-related sanctions that I think the kind of Western governments would not be willing to accept. But there are potentially other ways to ensure that those don't expire. But in any case, I think snapback is really a political signal and less of an economic tool. So there aren't kind of sanctions that or economic tools that the snapback would kind of bring to bear that the U.S. isn't deploying already. So I don't think there is kind of being held in reserve these massive sanctions that, you know, the West is just unwilling to deploy. It's really a tool that signals the end of the nuclear negotiations. It brings in place some restrictions. The UN arms embargo would come back into effect, for example. And so I think those are not irrelevant, but the kind of idea that there's kind of something waiting in the wings that would have a big effect, I think, is not accurate.
Do you think that the U.S. and its allies have any credible military deterrent that they're kind of working on? I mean, we do hear often that from the U.S. perspective, all options are on the table. But is anything actually being done in practice with that kind of strategy?
So I think for the U.S., let's take apart those words, credible military deterrent. I think likely from the point of view of Iranian leaders, the U.S. has a clear, well-honed military option that it could deploy in this case. The real question, I think, is around the first word, is around credibility. I would expect the U.S. to emphasize over the coming months and potentially years the kind of both aspects of that, the fact that it is credible and the fact that there is a military option that exists. And there are lots of ways you can do that. I mean, and it doesn't have to be only within the realm of the Iranian nuclear program. For instance, U.S. conducting airstrikes against Iranian-backed militias in Iraq or Syria can be used as a way to signal credibility from a broader point of view. So I would expect that would be where there's lots of effort. Israel, to a certain extent, has the opposite challenge, where it has a high degree of credibility, but the capabilities are fewer. So I think the Israelis will be working on building up those capabilities at the same time to try to strengthen that option as well.
Well, Henry Rome, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking to us from here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Iran carried out more military strikes on Iranian Kurdish opposition groups in northern Iraq's Kurdistan region from November 20th to the 22nd. The U.S. State Department strongly condemned what it called Iran's repeated and brazen violations of Iraq's territorial integrity and called on Tehran to refrain from further violence. Rikar Hussain is a journalist in VOA's Kurdish service. He joined me in the studio and explained how Iranian Kurdish opposition parties ended up in Iraq.
So to understand those parties, you really have to go back to the history of Iranian Kurds. The Iranian Kurds speak Sorani, so do their brethren in Iraqi Kurdistan. They share the same culture, the same dialect, and Iranian Kurds have been very active in Kurdish nationalist movement. That's basically in 1946, we had the Kurdistan Republic established in Mahabad. That's a city in Iranian Kurdistan. So Iranian Kurdish cities have really been a hub for Kurdish movements. And after 1991, when the Iraqi Kurdistan had its own revolution and had an established region that we recognize as the Kurdistan Regional Government of Iraq now, these Iranian Kurdish parties were pushed out by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Having a stronger Islamic Republic basically made it impossible for Iranian Kurdish parties to stay. They moved to Iraqi Kurdistan, and they have been taking refuge since then.
What do you know about the damage sustained in these attacks? What have been the reports of damages and casualties?
So it's hard to determine the numbers exactly, but we could say that dozens have been killed and close to 100 have been injured. And so the attacks have really escalated to target party headquarters, especially with Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iran. Very recently, we spoke to a few leaders who were talking about how they are facing unprecedented attacks in terms of cybersecurity, cyber attacks on their phones. Their Iranian drones are 24/7 monitoring their locations. With Kurdistan Freedom Party, last week we had an interview with their spokesperson who for the first time said that their leader, whose name is Hussein Yazdan Panah, was actually the major target. The Iranian military wanted to kill him in the latest attack last week.
And what happened?
The Iranian government said, their website said that he was injured and he was taken to a hospital. But the party spokesperson said, no, these claims are not true and he's safe and sound.
Has Iran been open about why it's doing this? Has it said what its motivation is?
So if you listen to the Iranian official statements, they will tell you that they're doing this because these Kurdish militant parties, they call them terrorists, to be clear on that. They will say are encouraging protests. They are moving arms around across the border between Kurdistan region of Iraq and the Kurdish region in Iran. However, if you look at the facts and if you see, also take the statements from the Kurdish, Iranian Kurdish officials.
Yeah, what have they said?
It's a very different story. They do say that Iran is startled by what's happening with the protests that started after the killing of Kurdish woman Jina Amini. And Iran has always really been a little more afraid in the Kurdish region. And this is something that has happened in the past with protests. Whenever you have protests in the Kurdish parts of Iran, you have the Iranian military jumping in right away with iron fist hand. And they are definitely afraid of what's going on with the Kurdish region more than in other places.
What will you be watching out for, as this conflict goes on? What is interesting for you about this?
I am very interested to see what Iran's going to look like after the protest. And I think that's something everyone can agree with. We are not clear what's going to happen. We don't know if the regime is going to stay in power. But I've heard it a lot among Kurdish groups and the Kurdish political circles saying that the one statement that repeats over and over is Iran is never going to be the same. And I am interested to see the new Iran.
I think we all are. Rikar Hussain, journalist with the VOA Kurdish Service, thank you so much for joining me in the studio here.
Thank you, Michael.
That brings us to the end of this week's program. There's more VOA coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Michael Lippin. On behalf of the Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us again next week.